Thank you for downloading episode one of 60 Minutes With. I'm Dave, and in each episode, I'm going to be chatting with a broad spectrum of people from the entertainment industry. And I begin by chatting to a writer. Now, this guy, he's written a couple of the Hellraiser films. We chat about Kiss because he wrote Detroit Rock City. You'll find out what the link is between Barbed Wire, Leprechaun 2, and Scream 2. There's a lot to fit in into this 60 minutes, and we just about do it in time before the alarm goes off. There's a couple of audio feedback issues, but I can assure you that it does not spoil your entertainment that you're going to get as I spend 60 minutes chatting with Carl Dupree. Hey, Carl, thank you so much for joining me in this first show.
Excellent. Thank you. It's good to be here with you, David.
It's been a while since we've chatted, to say the least.
I know. What an amazing, it's been a while. We'll just say that. I don't want to say how much time's gone by, but it's been a hefty chunk.
It certainly has. I mean, the last time we saw each other face to face, we were in Romania on the set of Hellraiser Hellworld, many years ago. And this is a good a place as any to start. Because you wrote two of the Hellraiser films, you wrote 6 and 8, which was Hellseeker and Hellworld. And it leads me into asking, because I'm sure a lot of listeners don't know the difference, you're credited as written by for Hellseeker, and you're credited as screenplay for Hellworld. Could you explain what the difference is between being credited as writer and being credited for screenplay?
Well, that might be a question for the WGA, you know, the Writers Guild of America, as far as credits go. But I can tell you that they were two completely different experiences, and I can see why I received the written by credit for Hellseeker was because Hellseeker was a sort of a blank pit right from the start. I had to come up with a story, and I worked with the director a lot on that, but it was a completely original story. It was just like a total blank page experience, which is daunting and it can be intimidating. But we had a great time doing that, and we actually came up with what I thought was a very original, cool story that was still in keeping with the Hellraiser mythology, you know, and paid respect to, you know, to Clive Barker and all that. And if you remember, it was an original story, but we did have characters from the first Hellraiser, which they take care of that with, you know, it's based on Clive Barker's work. So, but I can see why I would get a written by on that, because I technically the origin of the story was with me.
Yeah.
And there, like I said, I worked with the director, and if I remember, he actually brought another writer on after me. The story spawned in me. So there's that. With Hellseeker, there was an existing short story, and this is interesting. It wasn't really, it was a treatment for a script that was written by the executive producer Joel Soisson, and it had nothing to do with Hellraiser or Pinhead or anything. It was a story about a bunch of kids who go to this mansion, and they're at this party, and all these weird things start happening. It's a very scary story, very effective. But what they wanted to do was to inject Pinhead and the Hellraiser universe into this story. So just keep in mind, it was a pre-existing story, and what I did was I Hellraisered it up. I put in Pinhead. I made there's this villain in the story who's consistent with the villain in the original story, but the big difference is he made a deal with Pinhead and the Cenobites, and the character played by Lance Henriksen. And so in that sense, the story wasn't completely mine originally. You know what I mean? It came from a source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't a Hellraiser or a Clive Barker source, it was still a source. So that's why I got a screenplay by on that one. It was more of I was coming in to rewrite something that had already been written, in a sense. You know, it was a massive rewrite, but still, you know, the seed of all that began with someone else. Whereas the seed for Hellseeker was with me. That was you know, I was the person who started it, so if you will.
So what was more of a challenge for you then? Was it starting with a blank page and you've got to come up with the whole story and the whole idea as a Hellraiser film? Or is it going into it where you've got to adapt a pre-existing story? What's the hardest one to do?
Well, these are very subjective things that you're talking about and writing. As with any creative process, what's difficult and what's easy. I would say, yes, the Hellseeker was a more difficult script to write. And here, you know, here's another interesting thing. They already had a script written for Hellseeker, which oddly enough had a lot to do with the internet and technology and computers, which, if you remember, that was in Hellworld, right?
Yeah.
But this one, that we had this script, and the director, Rick Boda, I love him. His whole thing was, I can't make a movie where people are yelling at computer screens. I can't do that. He said it would look absolutely ridiculous. So I'm reading the script, and every other scene has these people going, no, oh, please, God, and they're in front of these computers, you know, and it's like really, it was ridiculous. It looked like, you know, something out of a scary movie. So we chucked out that script, the entire script. We didn't keep anything. It was really funny. So, like, right then and there, when we agreed to do that, I was just like, oh no, what have I done? This is it. We gotta start from square one. And it was we'd meet often, and I would write, and we keep writing, and it was a long process. And it is, any writer can tell you that staring at that blank page, it's or blank screen, as it were, because, you know, we're living in the age of computers now. But looking at that is as scary as any Hellraiser movie. It's a scary experience. You're like, what do I do now? But also there is a joy. And again, you know, any creative person can say there's a joy when you start putting stuff down and it's working and it's really working well and you can tell. And I just love that. I love taking meetings with Rick and the producers of Hellseeker, where, you know, we were going over parts of the script and like, oh my God, you know, like if you can make someone gasp or jump when they're reading a script, that is it. It's like if you're writing comedy and you can make someone laugh when they're reading the script, what an achievement. And so there was a much like bigger sort of creative payoff, I should say. Even though it was more difficult, it was a huge payoff for me when the script was finally finished, at least the draft that I worked on, which is very close to the finished product, to have those experiences where I'm scaring people who've read the script, and like people are emailing me, like I just got to the part with the vending machine or something like that. Like this guy was up all night because he read there's a part in the, it actually made it into the movie where somebody's looking at a vending machine and they see something like in behind like the candy bars, and this hand comes out and presses against the glass very quickly. And it worked, you know, when it was in the way it was laid out in the script, this guy said he couldn't get to sleep after he read that, the producers, Jesse Brodnicka. And, but with Hell World, it was more easily. And if I remember correctly, I wrote the script in 10 days, and I don't know if there are any screenwriters out there. Okay, this is sort of like this. We're in the, you know, Michael Jordan zone of screenwriting right now with this, because when I tell you these, I wrote 10 pages a day and I was finished in 10 days with that script. But the cheat there was already an existing treatment. So but I wasn't like just flashing out the treatment. I was changing a lot to make it Hellraiser-ish. And so it was like a slam dunk, but I jumped on that trampoline. You know what I mean? I had to jump on a trampoline in order to make that slam dunk. But it was 10 days. It was really, it flowed right out. It was great. At first, you know, now that you mention it, I was pretty scared, because when I read the script, I'm like, how is this going to fit into the Hellraiser mythology. You know, how's this going to fit into this? And I had to sit there for a while before I actually put, pen to paper, as it were, metaphorically speaking, you know, but to sit there and go, how is this going to fit into Pinhead, Hellraiser, the Cenobites? This isn't, you know, where am I going to put the box, you know, all that stuff. And of course, we had already, when I was on, you know, backtracking again, Hellraiser 6, we figured out that by that point, by the time you get that far into a series, you know, a franchise, you don't really have to put Pinhead in all that much. You don't have to put the Lament configuration or the center. You only need a hints, shadows, you know, and you got to, I mean, you got to pay off, you know, that recent Godzilla movie. I guess Godzilla was in it for about 2 minutes or something. but apparently there were like these little glimpses of Godzilla along the way, you know, and that was, I guess there was like a 20-minute fight scene at the end, actually, was what they were saying. But with Hellworld, you know, just put it, all we needed was the box in one scene. All we needed was these little scenes with Doug Bradley as Pinhead, very quick, and that, you know, you throw that, and the fans feel like they've been satisfied, you know, because we've gotten so far into it, you know what I mean? And I think we used, if we had, you know, clearly, like there's a problem, one of the symptoms of sequelitis is when you use something too much that's been used before, you know, overuse it. I think that's my opinion. So I was very happy with the way that turned out. And yes, it was an easier process. But Hellworld is a lot more fun for me personally, because I got to be flown out to Romania. You know, I got put up in the hotel. I was there, and I got to see a good chunk of the movie get made, which was fantastic. I got to meet the actors. That's always wonderful when a writer can meet the actors who are saying the words that the writer's putting down on the page, and brilliant people, all of them. And I don't have to wonder whatever happened to Henry Cavill either. You know, he wound up doing okay. You know, he's all right now, and he was a cool guy. I thought he was really awesome. You know, just like a kind of a wild man. You know what I mean? But like, I was like, this guy's got a pretty good future ahead of him. You know, I did say that to myself. I said, "Why?" I was actually wondering at the time why he wasn't doing anything bigger. But anyway, there you go.
Yeah. I remember my claim to fame is that I played pool quite a lot with all the cast at night, and Henry never beat me at pool. So I can say Superman can't beat me at pool. That's my claim to fame now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yes. So seeing that movie and just like, oh yeah, I hung with that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and him go way back.
So what's it like then? It must be such a great feeling when you see these actors, and they're performing these, you know, the words that you've sat there and written. And do you envision the character, maybe what they look like when you're writing the script, or have you got any sort of idea in your head of what you think they should look like? And does it make a huge difference when you see them on screen and they're totally different to how you originally thought them?
Yes, that is a great question. Wow, that is great, because when I was writing, first of all, with Hellworld, and I guess I'll stick with Hellworld because I did get to meet the actors and I got to hang with them and sort of like catch their vibes, what they were about as people too. Not that that matters, because they're playing characters, but it matters a little bit, because then you can see what their strengths are and you can sort of exploit that. But I'll backtrack a little bit on Hellworld. You know, obviously there's an original story written there. So there were characters that were kind of laid out, and those characters were in my head. And as I wrote the first few drafts of Hellworld, I did have sort of generic horror movie characters in my head. When I say generic, I mean, like, I grew up with you know, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, And it was, so it was a cast full of sort of like these white bread suburban characters, you know, characters from those movies, stock characters. And then, you know, they kind of like, how can I put it? The more I got into it, I could say, okay, this one, like there was one character who didn't swear. Like I was like, okay, I can see that, like this character, you know, she looks, you know, the to go beyond the looks and to give these characters personalities, that differentiate them from other characters, which is like always an important thing when you're writing. But like there was one character who didn't swear. You know, there were two characters who had, you know, sort of, they had a past. They were romantically linked. There were characters that were best buddies. And, you know, it's always nice to envision, like, and I know that there are some writers, and I've never personally done this, but they envision actual stars in the roles as they're writing, which I haven't been able to do. I come up with a character and it's like it comes out of a box, this character. I've never seen it before, never seen him or her, I should say. Never seen this character before. When I start writing, I open up this box and there's this character. And the character has a look and the character has sort of mannerisms and a kind of a personality already. I know the character's hair color, you know, all this stuff. I know what their voice sounds like, but and so that was like there was a lot of that on the Hellworld script, because I did wind up having to fabricate some characters. But once I got to that set and I met these people, and I was like, oh man, this is great, you know, because that's the thing about directing. Directors, I mean, I would. I'm always envious of a director who knows exactly the right person to put in what role. And I thought that when I met those actors, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's it. They didn't look like the way I had envisioned them. But once I met them, I could start saying, oh, wow, they can do that. Like, they can play this character and they can add their, you know, something else to it that I couldn't have envisioned when I was writing it. And like I said, I would meet them and I would catch their, you know what the strengths and weaknesses are. And as I was rewriting on the set, I could say, oh yeah, well, so and so would say it like this. And I, you know, like you figure out what they'd be able to, like how they'd be able to deliver a line, or how to word a line that could best be delivered by them in their voice, you know, as a person, you know. And that was it was very also on Detroit Rock City. There was a similar thing there, but the script was already written. Script had already been written, and I wasn't playing with the script anymore. But on this one, it was very nice to be able to sort of meet them and hang with them and mingle with them. You know, Anne, Catherine, Henry. They were and there was the guy who played Jake, who I remember he went on to what was it? Oh, man, it was like Teen Titans, I think it was at the time.
Okay.
If anybody that rings a bell with anybody, I can't remember the actor's name. But anyway, and I know there were more people. Of course, Lance. Oh my God, Lance Henriksen, the best.
He's amazing, isn't he? He was really good.
I love that. I love he. It's awesome. I love talking to him. He has such a nice voice. He always like this really this rich voice, that, you know, radio announcer type voice. But anyway, yeah, there was that experience.
Have you seen the latest Hellraiser? And if you have, what did you think of that one?
Oh my goodness, no, I haven't seen it. I'm going to see it, I think, someday. But in all honesty, I didn't. The reviews on that weren't too good, and I don't know, maybe I'm bringing my own baggage into it, but I said, well, I'll see it when it comes on Netflix, you know. But I still haven't seen it. So, did you wind up seeing it? Is it good?
Yeah, I've seen it. I think the weird thing is, because Doug Bradley isn't Pinhead, you know, that's the thing that constantly keeps smacking you in the face, and he's is hard to get over. I wouldn't say I was a huge fan of it, but it was. I've seen a hell of a lot worse as well. It's not glowing praise I'm giving it, I know, but it's a fair to middling, I think, is a good British phrase to use for it.
Right. Well, yes, I did not foray into that the new Hellraiser thing. There's also the thing of like as far as I'm concerned, and it's an ego thing definitely, but it's like, oh, what if it's really good? That's what I'm saying to myself. Suppose it's really, really good. A little bit of resentment there, you know what I mean? But I will check it out, and I did. I know it's I saw the poster for it, and that guy wasn't working for me. The guy was playing Pinhead, and he wasn't working for me too much. But
Yeah, that is the main thing, I think.
But I'm glad that they're continuing their. I don't know if they're going to be making any more of those, but good. It's good for them. It's good for Clive to have that get perpetuated. It's a good, the original book, The Hellbound Heart, is fantastic, and he's definitely a genius, horror icon, and I think that's great that they're pressing on with that and keeping that in the air. It's a great story.
Oh, it is, yeah, and I'm sure it's not the last we've heard of Hellraiser as well, because I've heard like Clive Barker's gonna, well, the last I read that he's gonna direct it possibly as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, this last one I meant to ask because the answer has never been entirely clear, but was it a reboot, a remake, a sequel?
No, it carried on, I think. As far as I know, and I could be wrong on this, it was made just so the studio could keep the rights to it. It was one of those that if they didn't
Okay.
produce anything, they'd lose the rights to it. And so, but it was, yeah, it just carried on. It didn't reboot it or anything. It was just like
Okay.
another chapter in the story.
Another chapter. I did enjoy, like I said, I wrote 6 and 8, and I saw all the previous ones, but it took me a long time. It took me about 10 years, I would say. Oh, there I go. I'm dating myself. All right. It took me about 10 years to watch 6. I mean, 7. That's what I meant. I wrote 6. 6 and 8. But 7, the one in between the two that I wrote. Isn't that funny? I finally saw it. I'm like, oh, this is a great movie. That was a really good, and that was the movie they made that at the same time as Hellworld. I mean, they
Yes.
Deader, and then I remember I flew out, and they were just finishing Deader, and they were just starting Hellworld. So isn't that funny? I finally got around to seeing that.
So you're all up to date more or less now.
So
You've got one more.
I got to watch that one more. Oh my goodness! It's good. It's Hellraiser, fantastic series. Fantastic movie, like original movie, groundbreaking, and then just a great franchise. There's definitely a lull kind of in the middle. There's you know what I mean? There's a lull, but I don't know, the outer space one, that was I still give that like an A for effort,
Yeah, that was number four, wasn't it?
yeah, number 4, but and of
Yeah.
course five was really terrific.
Oh yeah. I think everything ends up in space at some point in a franchise, doesn't it?
Remember the leprechaun wound up in space, isn't
I
that?
did, yeah.
Can I tell you something? This isn't. I don't mind telling people about my checkered past in the movie industry, but I was an assistant editor on Leprechaun 2, aka one wedding and a lot of funerals.
I was gonna bring this up because this is something I never knew about you,
Really?
and
Okay.
until this afternoon, I'll be totally honest with you. And I was going through your IMDb, and I thought, oh my God, I never knew like you were assistant editor. I was looking through these things, and I saw Leprechaun 2, and then I saw, oh my God, you worked on barbed wire as well.
Yeah, talk about kind of sort of black marks on your history there. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. It is what it is. A movie career is a movie career. Once you do it, you can't undo it. But I'm I'm proud of everything that I worked on because, you know, they were all great experiences for me personally. I'm not sure if movie-going audiences would agree that Leprechaun 2 or Barbed Wire were great experiences for them, but those cherished memories. You know what I mean? Cherished memories for
Oh
me.
yeah. I mean, you have got Evita on there and Mimic and Scream 2 that you're assistant editor on as well. And I'm sure people would hate if I didn't ask. What is an assistant editor then? What did you do on those?
All right. Well, what I did has been outmoded by computers now, but movie editing was done on celluloid, which is the physical print. Pardon me, it was a physical print of the movie, which everybody knows what celluloid is. You know, it's the frames that you hold up for the light. You can see all the frames, right? And they come in reels. And the sound is separate from the picture. Sound is recorded separately from the picture. And this is a really important part of what an assistant editor does. It's one of the main things. It's huge. But what an assistant editor does is sync up the sound to the picture. And that's what they have all the slate at the beginning, you know, take one, you know, you can hear that clap, the slate. And what an assistant editor does is they listen for that sound, the clack, and then they look for the place on the celluloid, the frames. They find that place where, if you can imagine those two pieces of wood connecting, you know, in solid and in focus. And that's how you sync. That's a quick, really, really quick lesson in how to sync dailies. You know, the dailies are the footage that come in every day from the movie set. But the syncing up the sound in the picture is actually a really, really important thing. And now they can do that on computers now, very easily. And the other thing that an assistant editor does is keep track of all the footage, and you create basically a library of all the footage. There's something like 100,000 feet of film that is shot, and there's something like 15,000 feet that winds up making a movie. So that's a ratio there, and I could be off. Maybe there's some assistant editors out there who can correct me and on that one. But anyway, the ratio is it's actually it's much more than 10 to 1. Now that I think of it, you know, it was for every foot of film that shot, or for every like say 30 feet of film that shot, 1 foot is used. Do you know what I mean? So
Yeah.
there's a huge library of that you've gotta like, and you've gotta describe like every scene. They're all broken up into scenes. Like this is the opening sequence, and you have all the footage from the opening sequence, all the takes. So there are 15 takes. Or if you're working on like a Kubrick movie, there are 100 takes. There are 100 takes of, you know, Jack Nicholson peeking through the wooden going, here's Johnny. And of course, you know, you have, so you have to keep track of all that. You have to keep, and you have to like keep track of which takes the director likes, which takes the editor likes. So it's a clerical work is what it is. It's a big time clerical job. It's all been outmoded by computers, Avid, Pro Tools, Lightworks, if they still use that. But that was my job was, you know, the editor was like, okay, we got this like scene where the scream guy, where the ghoul, the scream ghoul, he just stabbed whatever, Heather Graham. And he's standing there with the knife. I want to extend that shot so we can see him clean the knife off with his glove, right? Do you remember where that shot was? And like, I have to think, I have to go, all right, I need to find the extension of that shot. And usually they can tell by they number the feet. And then you get they number each foot of the film. But so the editor, there's kind of a shorthand there. He's like, can you get me the tail of scene 5, take 6, or something like that. You know what I mean? And that's I fetch that, you know. And the whole thing of being an assistant editor is someday you get to move up and become an editor, a regular editor, you know. But for now, you have to you have to worry about numbers and like footages and where everything is located in these boxes of celluloid. And everything, it's very sort of organizationally intensive job, and one that I had to kind of force myself to be good at. And there are a lot of editors out there right now who've been going, "Oh, Carl wasn't that. Carl, were you kidding me? That guy was awful." No, I'm just kidding. But it was something that I had to work at to get good at, because I'm not numerically oriented. I'm not sort of organizationally oriented. I'm more creative, but it was fun. It was fun working on all those movies. Especially Scream 2 was really a great point, because I got to meet Wes Craven. I got to, he would take us out to lunch. He would take the editing team out to lunch, and we get to sit and listen to all these stories about him making movies, back in the day, and it's just it was a great experience, that. And of course, every movie, when you're working on the cutting room, you really are experiencing, like, you get to meet all the people that you wish you could have met if you were like just on the set. If you're in the cutting room, everybody shows up. The big people show up. Sometimes you even run into some of the stars, which is it's really cool. It's great. I think if anybody out there wants to become a writer, director, or even just a director, or like me, like a writer, the editing room is a perfect place to start. Set work isn't going to get you too far if you're a production assistant. I mean, it's great. It's good to do that, but that's more of like if you want to become an AD, what's known as the guy who calls action and cut. Or if you want to become a director of photography, I would say being a camera assistant is pretty important. But if you want to get into producing, directing, writing, editing is like, the editing room is a really, really cool place to be. You can see how stories get put together on film. And you know what? As a writer, I was able to see what was working and what wasn't working when they were shooting. Like I would see the story coming together, getting pieced together, and I could see when the writer was being sort of vague about things. You could tell when they shot it was like this just isn't working. So I learned how to write for someone to you learn how to write visually, basically. You learn how to write using visual tools as opposed to literate tools, I guess.
Yeah.
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 Was it through your experience then as an assistant editor that then led on to you being a writer, or had you done that before? How did you get into writing in the first place?
Oh my gosh, what a question. Anyway, yeah, that's great. That's good. There's a whole story there. But I always wanted to be a director. I thought I was going to be like the next Steven Spielberg. I'm sure me and a million other people out in Hollywood, I was going to be the next Steven Spielberg. I was going to break in. I was going to make this awesome movie, blockbuster. I was going to direct it. And I got to Hollywood. I got to LA. And I was already writing my own stuff. I liked writing short stories. I wrote a play, whatever. But I wasn't thinking like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a career writer. That's not what I was thinking. I was going to be a director. And I got to LA, and I found out that one of the ways that people become directors is, there are two ways, actually. Two main ways that people become directors. One is to make a movie. And I don't need to tell you, it costs a lot of money to make a movie. It's ridiculous. You can't really just make a movie. And the other one is to write a script and to say, yeah, I want to direct this. If it's really good, people actually look at you for a second and go, no. But they'll give you that like little 1 second. And you know what? If you do that enough times, eventually people will start saying, okay, it's sort of the Quentin Tarantino school of screenwriting. That was a big inspiration for me, actually, because that's a great story. He wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And ironically, he wanted to be an actor. That was his story. But anyway, he wrote and wrote and wrote. And he kept saying, yeah, I want to direct this. I want to direct this. And people were like, nah, you know, we got Oliver Stone interested in this one. Nah, you know, we got, what else did he had a few movies with some different directors. Oh, Tony Scott, True Romance.
Yeah, of course. Great film.
Yeah, oh, it's an awesome movie. One of the best for Tony Scott and Quentin Tarantino, I thought it was that pairing. But you know, when you got Tony Scott interested, even though, like, you know, turn back, go back in time, pretend Quentin Tarantino was just this kid. Go, yeah, that's great. We know you want to direct it, but we got Tony Scott, the guy who did, you know, Top Gun and whatever, Crimson Tide. I don't know if he did Crimson Tide yet, actually. But anyway, you know, you got this guy. He's a name. You know, he's a name director. But eventually, Tarantino wrote enough scripts where, and you know, he wrote one that was pretty simple. That Reservoir Dogs was a pretty simple, basic script. Not uncomplicated though. It was good writing. And but he was able to make it on a modest budget, you know. But that was an inspiration for me. And I was writing, 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 writing. And you know, if I look back, the amount of writing that I did before I wrote Detroit Rock City wasn't that much. Detroit Rock City was, I believe, the fifth script that I wrote, which, I mean, actually, if you talk to writers out in Hollywood, I mean, there are people who write like 15 scripts and they're still working. So I got lucky. I lucked out big time. That was a very lucky experience. And I'm working in the editing experience with this, but yeah, I wrote like five scripts. I mean, Detroit Rock City was the fifth script. And I kind of got, oh, man, that is so funny because I wasn't living in Hollywood long. It only took me like 2 years to write. Now that I think of it, it took me like 2 years to write four scripts. So that's sick. But I was working on, or actually, yeah, I was working with an editor named Peter Schenk, who went on to actually edit Detroit Rock City. And we were working on a movie called The Stoned Age with a director named James Melkonian. And that was like, it was kind of a 70s, it had kind of a 70s vibe to it, but it was about these kids who want to get, they're basically going to a party and they want to get some action with some girls. And they were kind of Blue Oyster Cult fans. But it was really funny because I told this editor previously, I said, somebody should do like an I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is the movie about the Beatles that Robert Zemeckis made. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, I Want to Hold Your Hand. I said, somebody's got to write an I Want to Hold Your Hand, but with Kiss is like the Holy Grail. And he was like, oh, that's a great idea. So we're on this movie with James Melconian, and then that movie wraps. And of course, like, he is a big fan of the 70s, that director. And like, I want to say it was about 6 months later, where we were at lunch, and I went out to lunch with Peter and James Melconian. It was like a little bit of like a reunion type thing. And Pete like said, yeah, Carl's working on this Kiss movie script. I'm like, what? Because he remembered what I said. He's like, yeah, I'm working on this Kiss movie script. And James Melconian's eyes lit up. He's like, really? I'm like, yeah, it takes place in the 70s. He's like, really? That's awesome. And he goes, how far along are you with it? And I looked at Peter Schenk and I'm like, what's going on? I'm like, all right. I said, you know, I've been working on it for about 3 months. He goes, oh, really? So you should be like halfway done with it. I'm like, yeah. So I did the math in my head and I'm like, all right, so I got to write a script by April, which is like whatever, 3 months away. So it was really funny. It was a funny little thing of like somebody poking me, you know, somebody prodding me
Yeah.
into doing this. And I felt like killing that guy. I was like, how could you do? But it was the best thing that could have happened because I went on this like, I just, how can I put it? It was definitely like, I felt like boot camp. I was in boot camp. I put myself into boot camp, writing boot camp. I know I had written some scripts before, but I was like, I really want to make this I said, okay, I want to hold your hand. First thing I did was I rented I Want to Hold Your Hand. Then after that, I read the script for I Want to Hold Your Hand. And then I read it again, and I read it again. And I'm like, how can I make this like I Want to Hold Your Hand? But I was like, that Quentin Tarantino thing, I was really inspired by Pulp Fiction. And this is funny, the first draft of Detroit Rock City had each of their four main characters, their four kids. I had each one's story linear, like went through Jam's story, then I went through Hawk's story, then I went through Lex's story, beginning, middle, end, and they intersect, you know what I mean, at certain times.
Yeah.
So it was like this, it was a Tarantino. I turned it into a Tarantino thing, and then I said, no, I should probably not do that because it got kind of complicated, you know. I said maybe this wouldn't be a good idea for my first like big script to make it this weird, you know. So I wrote it. I then like wrote it just like I kind of like threw out. I said I'm gonna write beginning, middle, end. I threw out like the whole three act structure thing. I said, I'm just gonna write a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I'm gonna see what happens. And like I said, you know, these four kids go off into their own stories, and I just wound up doing this. Like I remember writing, like doing this diagram of like where each character would be at 6 o'clock at night, where each character would be at 6:15, where each character would be at 6:30. You know what I mean? It was like map, and I finally got it done, and then it was a lot of work, and then I gave the script to James Melcone. He loved it. He's like, oh yeah, this is a great script. He goes, so what does Kiss think of it? I don't know, Kiss. He goes, oh, all right, well, good luck, man. And I'm like, what? I felt like I went back to square one. That's it. I am never writing another script with an existing commodity in it. It's I can't do that anymore. I had an idea for this movie about Elvis working with an FBI agent on like this true story. Elvis was working with the FBI to bust these drug lords back in the late 60s, early 70s. I don't know if you ever saw the picture of him shaking hands with Richard Nixon, but that's what that's all about. He was an honorary FBI agent. But I was going to make a buddy picture where this guy, his partner is Elvis Presley. And
That sounds brilliant.
I was going to call it The King and Me. So, but I said, scrap that. I don't own Elvis. I don't have that copyright. So, but anyway, what wound up happening was I said, all right, forget this. I put Detroit Rock City in my desk drawer for like whatever, another 6 months. And I wound up on Barbed Wire. And the interesting thing about Barbed Wire, it was also edited by Peter Schenk. And which is another important thing there. I was working, you would swear, like we had like 20 assistant editors on this movie, all right? There was like a sound department, an effects department. It was like we were working on Apocalypse Now, you know what I mean? It was like this huge editing crew. And there's this one kid, and we would go, his name is David Feldman. We would be talking like we were side by side at our editing benches. That's what the editor's desk is called, a bench. And we were syncing up dailies. We were like syncing up the slate, and we're like, oh man, it sucks working on other people's movies. We want to work on our, you know, doing that thing. Like, when are we going to work on our own movies? And this kid's like, I want to make a movie about this. I got this idea, blah, blah, blah. And he's telling me stuff. He goes, you got anything in the works? And I said, oh yeah, well, I wrote this movie about these kids going to see a Kiss concert in 1978. And he flipped out. He said, I know this actor named Kevin Corrigan, who wants to play Ace Frehley in the Ace Frehley story. So I was like, oh, all right, cool. And I gave him the script, and he gave it to his friend Kevin Corrigan, who's like this indie actor. And I mean, he's been in a ton of stuff since then. I mean, at the time he's on the indie scene, and he loved it so much he gave it to his manager, and his manager gave it to this woman who wanted to get into producing, a casting agent, casting director, wanted to get into producing movies, and she was partnering with a guy named Barry Levine. And this all happened without me knowing. Like, the script started traveling around, you know what I mean? and it wound up on the desk of this casting director who was going to lunch with Barry Levine. And when she showed him the title of this script, Detroit Rock City, he goes, "Oh, is this about Kiss?" And she's like, "Yeah." He goes, "As I used to photograph Kiss back in the 70s, you know, they're getting back together again. They're going to put the makeup on." This was 1976. He was getting on a plane to go to London to shoot their reunion thing, the Psycho Circus deal. So just think, I mean, just think about like how like the stars came into alignment on this. I gave David Feldman this copy of Detroit Rock City. And then like, I want to say about 2 weeks later, the phone rang and it was Barry Levine. And he goes, "Yeah, Gene loves the script." And I was like, "Gene, what do you mean? Who's Gene?" I was so out of the loop of where, how this film tracked. He goes, "Gene Simmons, you fucking moron." He goes like that. I'm like, "What? Gene Simmons?" Apparently he got on that plane. He went to London and on the flight, he read the script. And then when he got off the plane, he gave it to Kiss's manager. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. You know, they attached themselves to the script then. And things started happening very quickly. And it's the reason why, like, this the whole Peter Schenk connection, that editor, he is Adam Rifkin's main editor. And Adam Rifkin, as you know, wound up directing Detroit Rock City. And so Adam was totally, like, in the loop. When I was writing Detroit Rock City, you know, he was like in the loop on all that. Like he followed my progress when I was going through the drafts and all that. And wouldn't you know, like once all that started happening, Adam's name came up as a potential director, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I know all about this script." He's like, my editor. This is like an assistant editor friend of mine. He goes, "Yeah, I totally know about this," and it was pretty amazing. It was like just, I don't know, kind of like everything fell into place on that. Now, at the same time, you know, once Detroit Rock City started happening, I still, like, that was all, there was interest in the script, which as any screenwriter in Hollywood can tell you, that and 50 Cent won't even, like, buy you a cup of coffee today. But there's interest in the script, that one. At the same time, I was going on to work with Patrick Lussier, the guy who cut Scream 2 and Mimic. And he's a big horror fan, as you probably know. And I wrote a horror script also. It was a script that I wrote right after Detroit Rock City. And it was called Roadkill at the time. The title that I wound up giving it was Next Exit 100 Miles. And it was kind of a creature horror movie, like Aliens. And Patrick Lussier read that script and he loved it, and he was poised to direct his first feature, which was The Prophecy 3 with Christopher Walken. And he brought my script, my horror script, to Dimension Films, and they loved it enough to give me a chance to work on the script with them. And so two things happened at once, and it was because I was working in the editing room both times. Peter Schenk was a huge connection. Patrick Lussier was the other huge connection. And, of course, David Feldman, who was another assistant editor. You know, so we got two editors and one assistant editor really influencing my career quite a bit. So
it's amazing, though, isn't it? Like you said, the set of circumstances that happened for all of this to pan out is just incredible.
Oh yeah. It blew my mind. It really, really did. It was. I couldn't believe how quickly things happened. And you know what? The Detroit Rock City experience. I'm still like, that's a sole writing credit, and if you watch that movie, 99% of what is on the screen was what was in the script, what was on the page. Very little. There were some ad libs here and there. But 99% of what you see on the screen is mine. So I take the credit or the blame for anything that you like, just like that's me. It's amazing to me. And of course, like I know there are actors in the movie, and the movie was directed. Blah blah blah. You know, Adam's a good buddy of mine still, but really, the reason why I'm saying that is because so few writers have ever had that experience of having a sole writing credit and a script that was not. And the advantage was that New Line Cinema wanted to take advantage of the KISS phenomenon at the time, that they rushed it into production. They greenlit it right away, and they had such a short pre-production schedule that they didn't even mess with the script. And of course, I had Adam Rifkin. Adam Rifkin was in my corner all the way, and one of the producers, Tim Sullivan, was a really big fan of the script too. And they agreed. They're like, "Let's just shoot this. Let's just do this," which it never happens in Hollywood. Never. Never, never, never. So I had a sort of golden ticket experience, and it's something that I'm eternally grateful for. And at the same time, The Prophecy 3, I mean, what writer doesn't want to have Christopher Walken deliver their dialogue? Like, what's that movie? I'm like, he's sitting there in the DMV, and he's talking to the person in the DMV, and there's a joke about, not the DMV, he's talking to a policeman about, the joke is about the DMV. Anyway, I won't tell you the joke. You'll have to see the movie. But I'm listening to him say my sort of one-liner joke dialogue, and I'm like, oh, man, that's it. My life's complete now. You know, Christopher Walken spoke my words. That's it. I'm done.
that's so good.
it was great. Good. Those are two very good experiences. And yes, where would I be without the cutting room? You know, without the editing room, it really was a major experience. And you know, now that I think of it, it was something that I had a cousin who was living in LA at the time, and she was a production assistant. And I told her what I wanted to do, which is what everybody wants to do. I want to write and direct. She goes, "Oh, you want to probably just start in the editing room," which I didn't. I never would have thought of doing that. I was used to being a production assistant and working on the set. But this is pretty funny. I called Roger Corman's studio, which is at the time it was New Horizon, but I harassed them every single day until they put me on this movie called Blood Fist 5, Die Trying, with Don the Dragon Wilson. And it was the worst, like, 2 weeks of my life. But I was so grateful because I was like, I learned how to do everything. In 2 weeks, I learned what most assistant editors get taught in like 2 years, because that was the kind of environment it was brutal. It was 12 to 14 hour days, you know what I mean? But it was awesome. It was an awesome experience. I don't know, the whole thing was amazing.
It is, it's so good. It's like from the start, from being an assistant editor, where the different paths that it took you. And oh, yeah. One of the things I'm going to have to get used to with these is that it's 60 minutes. I'm just looking at the countdown timer. We're down to just under 8 minutes. I still want to find out what you're up to now and what you get planned in the future. I can't get onto that yet because I'm such a huge KISS fan. And I know KISS fans are listening to this. I did watch Detroit Rock City again a couple of nights ago. Still holds up strong. Still love it. I mean, you don't have to be a KISS fan. Anybody listening to this, you don't have to be a KISS fan to watch it. It's still a really funny film. If you are a KISS fan, though, there's so many little nuances you're going to get. It's like the girls' names with Beth and Christine. I love the bit where they're talking about the rumours about Gene's tongue and that how he's got a cow's tongue grafted and he'd had the little bit of the skin under his tongue cut, because I remember as a 14-year-old kid hearing those exact same rumours. So that's always really good. I've got to ask you, KISS fan to KISS fan, there's two questions that always gets asked, so I'd be hung, drawn, and quartered if I didn't.
All right,
they're quite old, boring questions. But what's your view on Tommy and Eric in Ace and Peter's makeup? And Gene and Paul have said for a while that there will be a KISS 2.0 without them. What's your two views on those in a couple of minutes, if you can, Carl?
All right. Well, I don't think I'll need a couple of minutes. I can say in a very short period of time that I was disappointed with all that. I was very disappointed, and I'm not on board with that. I grew up And you know, maybe it's just because I'm so nostalgic and I'm so attached to the Kiss that I knew when I was a kid. And I did lose interest. I gotta tell you, I lost interest once Ace and Peter were gone. And you know, still, like, it was a different band to me, basically. And I still enjoyed their music to a certain degree, but the mystique was gone after that for me. And to have all this happen now is just kind of it's heartbreaking. You know, it's disappointing. And I mean, I know there are probably a lot of people out there who are into this, but it's just for me, you know, Kiss will always be, you know, Paul, Gene, Ace, and Peter in their makeup, and Kiss Alive 2. Kiss Alive 2 was like just Nirvana for me. You know, just like just the second coming. I don't know how else to put it. It was awesome. You know, I mean, it was just like that whole experience. That was the tour that I saw them on, by the way. You know, but I mean, I dug Dynasty. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, had the disco song on it. But that was.
That's such another great reference in the film as well.
I know. I know. 1001 Movies You Need to See Before You Die. It's a YouTube video. It's called 1001 Movies You Need to See Before You Die. And it has, well, it has an Easter egg in it that's really cool. And that's all I'm going to say. But getting back to Kiss again, not on board. Not down with that. I don't, you know, and the Tommy and Eric thing, I'm just not. I'm not into it. And I was very. I was like, why didn't they just, you know, even that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing? I'm not. I just. I wanted to see the four, the original four, get back together, and I'm very staunch about that. That's my firm belief. So you can count me as one of those people. You can count me as one of those. I don't know what your views are, but I just want to come out of the gate and say that. You know, Kiss for me is preserved in time, you know, back in the olden days. And the new stuff, fine, whatever. I'm glad I could do it without a little the drama too that has there's all kinds of drama that's happening with Ace and all that, you know. But whatever.
There seems to be constant drama lately with them.
I know. Well, it's getting, you know, it's getting them attention and all that. That's good in a way, but I really would have loved to have seen the original lineup. Again.
Anyway, before that, we're going to have in 3 minutes, we're going to have the countdown timer alarm. It's going to go off and cut us off.
All right.
Please tell the listeners what you're up to now, what you've got planned for the future.
All right. Well, what I wanted to do is pitch this. It's called the 48-Hour Horror Film Project, and it's something that it's going on all over the country. But I'm running the Rhode Island chapter of it, and the web address is www.48hourfilm.com/providence/horror. And the 48-Hour Film Project is what happens is a bunch of teams, filmmaking teams, get together. And they have 1 weekend, 48 hours, to make a horror movie, a short horror movie. And it's a competition. There are prizes and all that stuff. And we got some cool judges. Actually, Peter Schenck, the editor of Detroit Rock City, is one of the judges. And then there are a bunch of people who've worked on Carl Dupre movies who are actually some of the other judges. There was a movie that I wrote, and it was filmed here in Rhode Island in 2010 called Incubus with Robert Englund, you know, Freddy Krueger fame. And a lot of people who worked on that are judges in this also. And anyway, I'm really proud of it. And anyway, go register your team at that address, and I'll be seeing you on October 17th. Which is the kickoff date. So there you go. There's the
That's
48-hour film project.
That sounds really good. Again, I'll put the links up on the
Cool.
Facebook and Twitter too. and get the word out there. Yeah, that sounds really good. Now, I know that the alarm's going to go off any minute now.
Oh, no.
So before it does, I want to say, Carl, it's been so good chatting to you. And we need to chat again. We don't need to leave these sort of 12-year gaps before we talk to each
I
other,
know.
do we?
I know. There was so much that we didn't cover. I'm surprised. So much time went by. The just great talking to you, and yeah, it's let's definitely do this again. I would love to have like a part two at some
Yeah,
point, you know, it'd be
definitely.
get all the stuff I can talk about Detroit. We can do one on the Detroit Rock City script someday. I can fill you in all sorts of stories that some of them might be really surprising, others will not be surprising at all. You'll be like, yep, you know.
Right. It's you're on
What's
then.
that?
You're on. I'm already. I'll pencil you in. A part two coming in already.
Nice. All right. Well, yeah, good talking to you too, David. And this I can't wait to hear the interview. And it's hard to believe that. Boy, yeah, Hell World was where it all began. That's pretty hilarious.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Carl. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, David. Have a good day.
And so the countdown alarm has sounded, and that ended my 60 minutes with Carl Dupree. I'm sure that you've had a great time listening to it as much as I did having a chat with him. I'm really going to have to get used to this 60-minute time period that I've got with people. So much more to ask him, so much more to chat about, and I think we can definitely pencil him in for a Detroit Rock City special, an hour chatting about Detroit Rock City and Kiss. That ticks all the boxes for me. Hopefully for a lot of you that listen there, that listen to this as well. At the moment, I haven't got a website or email address. The best way that you can get in touch with me and follow everything that's happening and keep up to date with news on guests and links, like the 48-hour horror film competition that Carl was talking about, is on Facebook and Twitter. So you need to go to facebook.com/60minutes with, and that's with a six and a zero, not the written word. And also on Twitter, it's at 60 minutes with, and that's again with a six and a zero. Obviously, as these episodes go on, I'll keep you updated with all the news on the website and everything that's happening like that. iTunes reviews would be welcome. If you could, they all help to raise the profile of the show, which is very important because it's the early days, and it also helps to get more guests as well. So that if you could spend a few minutes writing an iTunes review, that would be fantastic. Thank you very much. These shows are not scheduled weekly. I'm going to fit them in between episodes of, well, of course, when we do 80s Picture House. If you've not listened to that, go to 80spicturehouse.co.uk for all the podcasts that we do there with myself and Tom. But I'm trying to keep these as regular as I can. So again, follow on Facebook and Twitter, and you'll get all the updates, and you'll know who I'm going to talk to and when the shows will be out. But if you subscribe on iTunes, it will automatically be delivered to your MP3 player of choice. So, thank you for listening. I will be back before too long chatting with another guest. Thank you.